Chapter 3
"Papa!" shouted Fanny as she ran, still 200 yards from the coach house. "Papa, your uniform is come!"
"Fan!"
cried Charlotte, the fatter twin, several lengths behind.
"You are not to bawl out like that, and Miss O'Hara will hear you. You are to wait for me. Wait! Oh, do wait!"
Her sister flitted on, however, and Charlotte, coming to a halt, clapped her right hand behind her ear in the manner of her old friend Amos Dre, hailing the foretop in a gale of wind, and roared,
"Papa! Papa there! Your admiral's uniform is come!"
Then, hoarse with the effort, she added in little more than an ordinary shout,
"Oh, George, shame on you!"
For at this moment her little brother came racing into the stable-yard from the far end. With a better sense of timing and distance, he had cut across the kitchen garden, burst through the gooseberries, regardless of their thorns, and had dropped from the wall into the back lane. Now ran at full speed into the coach-house, where he gasped out,
"Papa! Oh, sir! Your uniform is come! In Jennings' own dog-cart!"
"Thank ye, George," said his father. "Jennings is always punctual. I do love a man that is true to his hour. Hold this strap, will you?"
He had been home long enough for the children to have grown quite used to him again, and now his daughters rushed in without the least ceremony, repeating the news as though vehemence and a wealth of detail, who saw the dog-cart first and from what distance, the colour of the horse and of the packages, their number and shape, would restore something to its freshness.
"Yes, my dears,"
said Jack, smiling at them. They were pleasant hoydens, between childhood and adolescence, almost pretty and sometimes as graceful as foals.
"George told me. Clap on to the buckle there."
He was wholly unmoved, and with some indignation Charlotte cried,
"Well, ain't you going to come and try it on? Mama said you would certainly come and try it on."
"There is no need. Everything was in order at the last fitting, bar a few buttons to be shifted and the epaulettes. Yet I may come up when George and I have finished this surcingle."
"Then please may we open the epaulette case? We've never seen an admiral's epaulette close to, but Miss O'Hara says we must not touch it on any pretext whatsoever without permission, and Ma has gone to fetch Granny and Mrs. Morris. Oh, Papa, won't you come up and put on just the undress coat?"
"Please, sir," cried George, "please may I see the presentation sword again? You will certainly wear your presentation sword in full dress. That's pos."
Jack ran up the ladder into the loft for an awl and a hank of saddler's twine.
"Well, bloody George,"
murmured Fanny, looking at his gooseberry wounds.
"You will cop it if Miss O'Hara sees you. Stand over and I'll wipe you with my handkerchief."
Charlotte directed her voice into the loft and called,
"Mamma will be amazingly disappointed if you do not come up, sir."
By the time Sophie returned with her mother and Mrs. Morris, Jack was in the blue chamber, which had a dressing-room that opened off it, and in this dressing-room Killick, with a fanatical glee and without waiting for any man's permission, had laid out the contents of all the tailor's parcels, although in himself he was as dirty, slovenly, and sea-bucolic as it was possible to be in the navy. He delighted in ceremony. For a grand dinner he would sit polishing the silver until 3 in the morning, and even more in fine uniform. Jack had gratified him much in the first, possessing a fair amount of plate, and then having been presented with a truly magnificent dinner service by the West Indies merchants. But hitherto he had almost always been a disappointment in the second, patching up old coats and breeches, and having them turned when they were too threadbare. It was true that during most of Killick's servitude, Mr. Aubrey had been extremely poor and often deep in debt. But now the case was altered. Supervine broadcloth in every direction, a dazzling abundance of gold lace, white lapels, the new button with a crown over the fouled anchor all agleam, undeniable cocked hats, a variety of magnificent swords and a plain heavy sabre for boarding, 2 bands of distinction lace, a star on the gorgeous epaulette, heavy with bullion, white kerseymere waistcoats and breeches, white silk stockings, black shoes with silver buckles. Having passed through the plain undress stage, pretty splendid nevertheless, Jack came out of the dressing-room in all the glory of a flag officer, his hair powdered, the Nile medal gleaming on his lace jabot, and his laced hat adorned with a diamond spray given him by the Grand Turk, a spray that was made to quiver and sparkle by a little clockwork heart.
"Behold the Queen of May," he said.
"Oh, very fine,"
cried the ladies, and even Mrs. Williams and her friend, who had been sitting there with pursed lips, disapproving of such expense, were quite melted, adding, "Glorious! Superb! Superb! Superb!"
"Huzzay! Huzzay!" cried George. "Oh, to be an admiral!" "How I wish Helen Needham could see him," said Charlotte. "That would clap a stopper over her prating about the general and his plume."
"Fan,"
said Sophie, rearranging her husband's neckcloth and smoothing the golden fringe of an epaulette,
"run and ask Miss O'Hara whether she would like to come."
A clock in the corridor struck the hour, followed by several others at different levels, the last of all being the slow, deep chime from the stable yard.
"God's my life!" cried Jack, whipping off his coat and hurrying into the dressing room. "Captain Hervey will be here."
"Oh, don't throw it on the floor," called Sophie, "and do please, please take care of those stockings as you pull them off. Killick, make him take the stockings off by the band."
When the men had gone, thundering down the stairs, Jack, dressed as a plain country gentleman rather than a sea-going peacock, and Killick, looking as usual like a lean, cantankerous and out-of-work rat-catcher, the ladies walked into Sophie's boudoir. Mrs. Williams and her friend sat together on an elegant satinwood love-seat with entwined hearts for a back, and Sophie in a low, comfortable elbow-chair with a basket of stockings to be darned beside it. She rang for tea, but before it came, her mother and Mrs. Morris had resumed their habitual looks of disapproval.
"What is all this we hear about those extremely expensive garments forming part, or indeed parcel, of an admiral's uniform? Surely Mr. Aubrey cannot be so thoughtless and indiscreet as to assume a rank superior to his own, a flag rank, no less."
The mention of high authority always brought a pious, respectful look to Mrs. Williams' face. Before it had quite faded, she interrupted Sophie's answer with the words,
"I remember a great while ago that he called himself captain, when he was really only a commander."
"Mamma," said Sophie, in a stronger voice than was usual with her, "I believe you mistake. In the service, we always call a commander captain out of courtesy. While a commander of the first class, that is to say a commodore with a captain, a post-captain under him, in this case Mr. Pullings—"
"Yes, yes, honest Tom Pullings," said Mrs. Williams with a condescending smile,
"is absolutely required, not just by courtesy but by admiralty rules, to wear the uniform of a rear admiral. So there,"
she added, sotto voce, but not altogether unheard, as the tea-tray came in. Even at Ashgrove, a tolerably well-run house with a strong tradition of promptness and order, tea entailed a fair amount of turmoil. But in time the older women were quiet at last, absorbed in stirring their sugar, and Sophie was about to make some remark when Mrs. Williams, with that prescience sometimes found in mothers, cut her short with the words,
"And what is all this about inquiries being made in the village concerning Barham Down?"
"I know nothing about them, Mamma.
Briggs heard that there had been a man in the alehouse asking about Barham Down and those that lived there, a man like a lawyer's clerk, and since he had to go there on some business to do with rat poison, he asked the landlord what was afoot, and it appeared that most of these questions were about Mrs. Oakes, not about Diana. It is not a matter of gathering evidence for a criminal conversation case, or a divorce with Diana as the guilty party, as I thought straight away, but something to do with Mrs. Oakes. Debts, I have little doubt. But it is also possible that that Mr. Wilson, the manager, had a wife somewhere."
Sophie had been brought up so straight-laced that she possessed no very exact notion of how babies were made in the first place or born in the second, until she learned from personal and startling experience, and one of the changes in her mother that surprised her most was this strong, almost obsessive, and sometimes singularly specific interest, disapproving interest, of course, in who went or wanted to go to bed with whom, an interest fully shared by Mrs. Morris, so that the two of them would go over the details of any fresh trial for crim con for an hour or more. She was reflecting on this when she heard her mother say,
"So, of course, I borrowed the gig and called, Briggs driving all the way up that steep, stony road to Barham. She was denied, but I insisted, said I wanted to see the child, my own grandniece, after all, my own flesh and blood, so I was admitted. I thought she was far too expensively dressed for a mere lieutenant's widow, and her cap was outré. I believe she has some pretensions to looks. Well, I questioned her pretty closely, I can tell you. What was her maiden name? Who were her employers in New South Wales? Did she teach the harp? Nothing so graceful as the harp. When did this curious, I did not say alleged, marriage take place? She was evasive, short, unsatisfactory answers, and when I told her of it, saying I expected more openness, she positively turned me out of the house. but I was not going to be put down like that by a chit worth no more than £50 a year, if that, and I said I should come back. In Diana's absence I have a right to supervise the bringing up and welfare of the child. If there is an undesirable connection in that house, she must be removed. I shall speak to my man of business, and I shall say,
"You are forgetting, Mamma," said Sophie, when the torrent paused. "You are forgetting that Dr. Maturin is his daughter's natural guardian."
"Dr. Maturin? Dr. Maturin? Pooh-pooh! Here today and gone tomorrow. He has been away 6 weeks at least. He cannot oversee the welfare of his child," said Mrs. Williams. "I shall have myself appointed supervisor."
"We expect him tomorrow afternoon," said Sophie. "His bedroom is ready. He is staying here, not at Barham, to be nearer the squadron during these last important days."
Stephen rode towards Ashgrove Cottage, sombre from his long and unsuccessful journey to the North Country, sombre from his stop at Barham, where he had heard of Mrs. Williams' barbarity, but with a somberness shot through and through with a brilliant gleam. In a small square room upstairs at Barham, overlooking the now almost empty stables, Diana had put a good many of his papers and specimens, a dry little room in which they might be preserved. On the other side of the passage, another room, sometimes called the nursery, held a number of unused dolls, a rocking horse, hoops, large coloured balls and the like, and as he sat arranging these papers, and sheet after sheet of a hortus siccus collected in the East Indies and sent home from Sydney, he heard Padine's voice from across the way. When Padine was speaking Irish, he stammered very much less, hardly at all if he were not nervous, and now he was discoursing as fluently as he could.
"That's the better. Bless the good peg. A little higher. Oh, the black thief, he missed the stroke. 4 it is. Now for the 5. Glorious St. Kevin, I have the 5 itself."
This was usual enough. Padine alone often talked aloud when he was throwing dice or knuckle bones or mending a net. Stephen did not so much listen as be aware of the homely, agreeable sound. But abruptly he stiffened. The paper dropped from his hand. It was exactly as though he had heard a faint, childish voice cry,
"12!
Or something very like it. 12 in Irish, of course. With the utmost caution he stood up and set his door on the jar, with a book either side to prevent it moving.
"For shame, Breed Honey," said Padine. "It is a dohiag, you must say. Listen, sweetheart, listen again, will you now? A hen, a doe, a tree, a cahir, a quig, a shea, a shocht, a hocht, a ne, a jay, a hen deag, a do yeag, with a noise like ye, ye. Now, a hen, a do."
The little high voice piped,
"A hen, a do,"
and so right through to
"a do yeag,"
which she said with just Padine's Munster intonation.
"There's a golden lamb, God and Mary and Patrick bless you," said Padine, kissing her. "Now let you throw the hoop on the 4, which will make 12 altogether, so it will too, since 8 and 4 is 12 forevermore."
The dinner bell clashed on Stephen's intensely listening ear with a most shocking effect, a galvanic effect. It scattered his wits strangely, and he had not fully recovered them before the passage outside creaked under Padine's step. He was a big man, as tall though perhaps not as broad-shouldered as Jack Aubrey, and it was clear that he was carrying the child. They talked in a murmur, each into the other's ear. Dinner was a silent meal, and after a while Clarissa said,
"I should not have told you about Mrs. Williams. It has taken your appetite away. But she forced her way into Bridget's room, crying that a good shake would cure this sort of trouble, and her clamour shocked the child."
"Sure, it angered me to hear of her conduct, the strong, self-willed, unruly shrew. But you were wholly and entirely right to let me know. If you had not done so, she might have repeated the intrusion with all the damage that would ensue. Now I can deal with it."
He stirred his wine with a fork for some little while, recollected himself, looked attentively at the fork, wiped it on his napkin, laid it square on the table, and said,
"No, it was not anger that took my appetite away, but delight. I heard Bridget speak clear and plain, talking to Padine."
"Oh, I'm so glad. But," she hesitated, "did it make sense?"
"It did indeed."
"I have heard them too, so has Nellie, but only when they were quite away by themselves. They were always together, you know, in the hayloft, or with the hens and the black sow." We thought it was only gibberish, the sort of language that children make up.
It is the pure Irish they speak.
I am so glad, said Clarissa again.
Listen, said Stephen, I think the balance is exceedingly delicate at this point, and I dare not make any move at all, dare not rush blundering in. I must reflect, and consult with colleagues who know much more than I do. There is Dr. Willis in Portsmouth. There is the great Dr. Lierz of Barcelona. For the now, I beg you will take no notice, no notice at all. Let the flower open.
Sometime later, he said,
How happy I am you told me of that woman. At the present juncture, her ignorant violence might wreck, spoil, desecrate. I shall cope with her.
How shall you do that?
Asked Clarissa after a pause.
I am contemplating on the means, said Stephen,
but the pale, reserved ferocity of his expression faded entirely with the entry of Nelly with the pudding and Padine with Bridget. She sat there on her high-cushioned chair, and as Stephen helped her to gooseberry fool, she turned her face to him. He thought he saw a distinct look of acceptance, but he dared not speak directly. It was only when the meal was nearly over that he said, in Irish,
"Padine, let you bring the little mare in 12 minutes."
And the words brought a quick turn of the small, fair head, ordinarily immobile, absorbed in an inner world. The little mare carried him, with a long, easy stride, down the miles of bare upland road, along the turnpike for a while, and so to the lane leading up through Jack Aubrey's plantations, to the knoll on which he had built his observatory. For Captain Aubrey was not only an officer professionally concerned with celestial navigation, but also a disinterested astronomer, and although one would never have suspected it from his honest, open face, a mathematician. A late-developing mathematician, it is true, but one of sufficient eminence to have his papers on nutations and the Jovian satellites published in the Philosophical Transactions, and translated in several learned journals on the continent. Jack had just closed the door of this building, and he was standing on its step, contemplating the English Channel, when Stephen came in sight round the last upward curve.
"Ho, Stephen!"
he hailed, though the distance was not great.
"Have you come back? What a splendid fellow you are, upon my sacred honour. True to your dead, almost to your hour. I dare say you could not wait to see the squadron. A glorious sight. Although it is nothing like what I promised you in the first place. No squadron ever is. I have been gloating over them this last half hour, ever since Pyramus came in."
And indeed the slide of the revolving copper dome was pointing directly down at Portsmouth, Spithead, and St. Helens.
"Should you like to have a look? It would not be the least trouble."
He glanced at Stephen's mount, paused, and in quite another tone he went on,
"But, Lord, how I rattle on about my own affairs. Forgive me, Stephen, how do you do? I hope your journey was—"
"I am well, I thank you, Jack. And I am happy to see that your head is mended, though you look sadly worn. But my journey did not answer as I could have wished. I had hoped to find Diana, and I did not. I came upon some of her horses, however. This is one."
"I recognized her," said Jack, caressing the mare. "And I, too, had hoped—"
"No. She had sold 2 mares and a stallion to a man that breeds running horses near Doncaster. He very kindly let me have Lala here, but he had little notion of Diana's movements apart from Ripon and Thirsk, where she had friends. She had spoken of Ulster, too, where Francis lives."
He swung out of the saddle, and they walked slowly on towards the stables.
"But that is of no great account. Do you remember Pratt, the thief-taker?"
"My God, I should think I do," cried Jack.
And well he might. Earlier in his career he had been accused of rigging the stock exchange, and Pratt, who was the son of a jailer, had spent much of his childhood among thieves, and who had improved his knowledge of the underworld by serving with the Bow Street runners before setting up on his own account, had acted for Jack and his lawyers, finding an essential witness in a masterly fashion. Masterly, but inefficacious, since the witness's face, upon which identification depended, had been, as one might say, erased.
"Well, I have retained Pratt and his colleagues to find her out, and I have little doubt of their eventual success. I do not mean to persecute her, you understand, brother. It is because she is labouring under 2 separate misunderstandings, both of which I wish to remove, an act that can be done only by word of mouth."
"Of course, certainly," said Jack, to fill the silence.
And the mare, turning her head, gazed at them with her lustrous Arabian eyes, blowing gently on them as she did so.
"You know about Bridget, of course. She is called an idiot, which is wholly incorrect. Hers is a particular form of development, slower than most. But Diana does not know this.
She believes there is idiocy which she cannot bear. Jack, too, had a horror of anything like insanity, and a word almost escaped him. And feeling no doubt that her reluctant presence was not only useless but positively harmful, she went away. She believes that I should blame her for doing so. That is the first misunderstanding. The second is, as I said, that she believes in this idiocy, and I wish to tell her that she is mistaken. Children of this kind are rarer than true idiots, who, I may say, can be told at a glance, but they are not very uncommon. There are two of them in Padine's village in the County Kerry. They are called Lanier Shie in Ireland, and both were, I will not say cured, but brought into this world rather than another. They were taken at the critical moment. Padine is the sort of person who can do this. He is strangely gifted.
I remember him taking a trapped cat in his hand and undoing the jaws with never a scratch. And there was the savage stone horse we took out for the Sultan.
Just so, and many another example. But in this particular development, in Bridget's particular development, the balance is extremely delicate. It may go either way. The circumstances, the physical environment itself, are so exceptional. I must consult with Dr. Willis. I must write to Dr. Lears in Barcelona, the great expert in these matters. Yet in any case, Mrs. Williams must be kept away. She called and savaged Clarissa with impertinent questions, and then insisted on seeing the child, her grandniece. She frightened her, offering to give her a great shaking if she would not speak. I am happy to say that Clarissa put her out of the house directly.
I have a great esteem for Clarissa Oakes.
So have I. But that woman shall not go to Barham again. I must have a word with her.
They were almost in the stable-yard, and Jack said,
In point of fact, she and Mrs. Morris are waiting for you. I said you would be here today, and they are waiting for you. They are in a great taking.
What's amiss?
Their man Briggs played the informer once too often. The hands caught him in Trump's Lane coming back from the ale-house and beat him. Black night, no words, only a din like a great puppy being whipped.
Oh, Dr. Maturin!
Cried the three children, more or less in unison, as they came running in from a sidewalk.
There you are! You have arrived! Grandmama posted us by the gazebo to look out for you. She and Mrs. Morris beg you to come at once. Briggs was set upon and terribly beaten by the Hampton Blacks. Mr. Owen, the apothecary, has plastered him and says he may live, but we doubt it. Please may we take you there at once? We were promised fourpence if we took you at once. Papa will look after the horse, will you not, dear Papa? She is a mare, stupid. An Arab, sir, I believe.
Stephen walked in, and when he had endured their clamour, indignation, and circumstantial account for some considerable time, he desired the ladies to leave him with the patient. He made his examination. Here, indeed, was a truly swollen, bloated face, and back and buttocks strongly marked with rope's end and cobbing board, but no broken bones, no incised or lacerated wounds. Stephen was surprised that a man long accustomed to the racecourse should be so upset by these moderate degrees of violence. Yet Briggs was quite prostrated, fright almost amounting to terror, dignity shattered, a sense of total outrage, and perhaps something close to abject cowardice. Stephen approved Mr. Owen's dressings, prescribed a few harmless, comfortable medicines, and crossed the passage to where the anxious ladies sat.
"He needs quietness, a dim light, and undemanding company," he said. "If Mrs. Morris would be so good as to sit with him, I will explain my treatment to my Aunt Williams, since our relationship allows me to use medical terms and expressions that I should be embarrassed to employ in the presence of any other lady."
"They have not cut him, have they?" cried Mrs. Williams when they were alone. "I trust that was not what you meant when you said embarrassed?"
"No, ma'am," said Stephen. "You will not have a eunuch on your hands."
"I am so glad," said Mrs. Williams. "I have heard that robbers often do it to people who resist them. They do it out of spite, knowing that gentlemen do so hold to their... You understand me."
"Is it known who the robbers were?"
"We are pretty sure, and I am going to lay an information with Sir John Wriothesley, the Justice of the Peace. At first we half suspected the seamen he had very properly caused to be admonished, yet Mr. Aubrey, Commodore Aubrey, flatly denied it, and he is practically a flag officer. But then it came out that they had black faces, so it was obviously the gang called the Hampton Blacks, who always blacken their faces when they go out at night to poach the deer. They may very well have known that he often carries considerable sums to and from Bath for us."
"Did they take anything?"
"No. He clung so bravely to his watch and money that they got nothing at all."
"Very well. Let him be quiet and dosed regularly, and I think I may assert that you will find him as good as ever in 7 days' time."
"He is in no danger, then?"
cried Mrs. Williams, "so I may send and countermand the priest? He will not charge if he is told in time, I am sure. Mr. Briggs is a papist, you know." Stephen bowed. Mrs. Williams said, "What a relief!" and rang the bell for some Madeira for the doctor. As he drank it, Jack always had capital Madeira, she said in a musing voice, "Not that I have anything against papists. Did you ever hear of Mrs. Thrale?" Stephen bowed again. "Well, she married one after her husband died, a man of somewhat lower rank and even a foreigner. But now she is received everywhere, I understand." "No doubt. Here is a brief list of the necessary measures and doses, which I desire you will adhere to with the utmost regularity. And now, ma'am, I wish to speak to you of my daughter Bridget. As you are aware, her mental health is delicate, but you probably do not know that its progress has now reached a critical stage at which any shock or setback may prove disastrous. I must therefore beg that for the present your kindly intended visits to Barham may cease." "Am I not to see my own flesh and blood? My own grand-niece? Believe me, Dr. Maturin," cried Mrs. Williams, her voice reaching its metallic, dominant ring, "these childish, self-willed, stubborn, obstinate fancies are best dealt with firmly. A good shaking, a black hole, bread and water and perhaps the whip answer very well, and at no cost, though to be sure you are a physician and everything in that line is free." "I shall be sorry to forbid you my house," said Stephen. But Mrs. Williams, well launched, carried straight on. "And let me tell you, sir, that I cannot at all approve of the young person in charge of her at present. Naturally, it was my duty to ask her a few questions to satisfy myself of her suitability, but all I got was short answers, unsatisfactory replies, a very repulsive reserve, a confidence and self-sufficiency, a want of submissive respect that quite shocked me. And there are rumours of debts, inquiries in the village, questionable morality." "I am perfectly well acquainted with the lady's antecedents," said Stephen in a more determined voice, "and I am perfectly well satisfied with Mrs. Oakes's qualifications as a person to look after my daughter. So let us have no more of this, if you please."
"I ought to be appointed guardian, with a right of inspection when you are away on these interminable voyages. I certainly have a moral right to visit, and a legal one, too, I am sure."
"I do not agree. And if, as I do not suppose possible, now that I have made my views clear, you were so unwise as to commit a trespass, you would not only be ejected by my powerful, dangerous Irish servant, but you would lay yourself open to a most determined prosecution, a prosecution not only for trespass, but also for keeping and having kept an unlicensed betting office. Furthermore, the least hint of such an indiscretion would infallibly lead to your man Briggs being pressed into the Navy and sent aboard a ship full of common and often violent sailors, none of whom has any reason to love him, a ship bound for the deadly West Indies, or perhaps for Botany Bay."
"Sir," cried George, intercepting him in the garden, "Papa says, would you like to take a quick glance at the squadron while there is still some light on the sea?"
"I should like it of all things," said Stephen.
"George, here is a 3-shilling piece for thee."
"Oh, thank you, sir, thank you very much. We never got our fourpence, but now Amos is just going down to Hampton, and I shall go with him and fairly gorge."
His words were lost in the distance.
"Come in, Stephen,"
called Jack from the depths, the very moderate depths, of the observatory.
"I have the glass just so. Mind the cantilever. Oh, never touch that sprocket. Take care of the eyepiece box, if you please. Never mind, I shall pick them up and clean them later. Now slide in here and sit square on the stool. Square on the stool. There. Leave that screw alone, for God's sake. Hold on to the turret casing, if you must hold on. It will be easier when your eyes have grown accustomed to the gloom. Gloom for contrast, you understand. There. Sit tight. I have shipped crosswires, as you see. No, get your eye right into the eyepiece, Stephen. What a fellow you are. In point of fact, they are stretched threads of spider's web, exactly placed. Ingenious, ain't it? Herschel's sister showed me how to do it. The focus is right for my good eye, but if you find it blurred, turn this screw," guiding his fingers, "until it is sharp. For the moment there is very little turbulence. The telescope is exactly pointed, so never touch anything else, whatever you do."
Stephen squared himself still more, thrust his eye even deeper into the eyepiece, drew several deep breaths, and timidly turned the screw. Instantly the cross lines showed clear, and at their intersection, broadside on, there was a ship of the line, sharp and distinct, in another world, another, though familiar, dimension. Her topsails were hanging loose to dry, and many of her people were over the side on stages, painting ship.
but this did not take away from her beauty, nor from the sense of concentrated power. It made a living ship of her, a ship with no collective self-consciousness and anxiety, holding her breath for her portrait or an admiral's inspection.
"Now there is the great, elegant ship of the world," said Stephen. "A 74, I make no doubt."
"Well done, Stephen," cried Jack,
and if he had been speaking to any other man he would have clapped him on the back.
"A noble 74 she is, and that red swallow-tailed Burgee is my broad pennant. The admiral sent his flag lieutenant particularly desiring me to hoist it, which I took very kindly. One has to have permission, you know."
"Sue, she is the Bellona, the chief argosy of your command. Huzzay! Huzzah! I congratulate you, Jack. Why, I declare she has a poop, which adds much to her dignity."
"And not only dignity, but safety, too. When you are on the quarter-deck in a hot action with a really malignant enemy firing great guns and small arms, it is a wonderful comfort to have a solid poop behind you."
"For my part, I prefer to be far, far below. Pray show me the rest of the squadron."
"There is the Pyramus," said Jack, moving the glass very slightly until the crosshairs rested on a fine 38-gun frigate. "She is like the French Belle Poule, you know. Frank Holden has her now, a fine, dashing fellow, but I doubt we shall keep her. There are nasty rumours of her being sent off on a cruise of her own and being replaced by something smaller, older, slower. I'm afraid the air is beginning to shimmer down over the harbour and Gosport," he went on, turning the telescope and guiding it by the finder. "But if you focus again for your eyesight, I think you will make out a ship creeping along by Pretty's Hard. She is the stately 64. She was given me when the Terrible, our other 74, was suddenly and very unfairly snatched away, and I'm afraid we shall certainly keep her. A 64-gun ship is a very pitiful craft, Stephen, worse in a way than the horrible old Leopard with a mere 50. In her we could run from the Dutch 74 without a blush, crack on until all sneered again with a clear conscience, but a 64 would have to turn and fight or feel dishonoured. Stately's captain, William Duff, you remember Billy Duff in Malta, Stephen, does all he possibly can, but, alas, the light is going, the sun has dipped. I can just make out the Aurora, 28, and the Orestes Brig, but they are fading, and I shall have to tell you about them when we have had something to eat. You must be cruel sharp set."
"With the blessing, I shall see them all tomorrow. I must be aboard early to attend to my assistance and medical supplies. How many are we in all?"
"To tell you the truth, Stephen, I do not know. There is so much chopping and changing. We are still a frigate short. It is just possible that we may lose the Pyramus. The sloops and brigs come and go, and the date is perpetually postponed. I should never have insisted on your coming back so soon. After all, I have known the Navy all my life, and never, never has any squadron put to sea on the date the Port Admiral or Commodore was told in the first place, nor with the same ships. But now, upon my word, you must and shall be fed. Sophie complains that she saw nothing of you because of the children's measles, keeps mentioning it. We will drag her from her accounts and sit down comfortably with a dish of muffins. You shall see the squadron by early morning light before breakfast, if it don't rain, and then we can ride down to Pompey."
Stephen had been put to sleep in his usual room, far from children and noise, away in that corner of the house which looked down to the orchard and the bowling green, and in spite of his long absence it was so familiar to him that when he woke about 3 he made his way to the window almost as quickly as if dawn had already broken, opened it, and walked out onto the balcony. The moon had set. There was barely a star to be seen. The still air was delightfully fresh with falling dew, and a late nightingale, in indifferent voice, was uttering a routine jug-jug far down in Jack's plantations. Closer at hand, and more agreeable by far, nightjars chirred in the orchard, 2 of them, or perhaps 3, the sound rising and falling, intertwining so that the source could not be made out for sure. There were few birds he preferred to nightjars, but it was not they that had brought him out of bed. He stood leaning on the balcony rail, and presently Jack Aubrey, in a summer house by the bowling green, began again, playing very gently in the darkness, improvising wholly for himself, dreaming away on his violin with a mastery that Stephen had never heard equalled, though they had played together for years and years. Like many other sailors, Jack Aubrey had long dreamed of lying in his warm bed all night long. Yet although he could now do so with a clear conscience, he often rose at unchristian hours, particularly if he were moved by strong emotion, and crept from his bedroom in a watch-coat to walk about the house or into the stables or to pace the bowling green. Sometimes he took his fiddle with him. He was, in fact, a better player than Stephen, and now that he was using his precious Guarnieri rather than a robust sea-going fiddle, the difference was still more evident. But the Guarnieri did not account for the whole of it, nor anything like. Jack certainly concealed his excellence when they were playing together, keeping to Stephen's mediocre level. This had become perfectly clear when Stephen's hands were at last recovered from the thumb screws and other implements applied by French counterintelligence officers in Minorca. But on reflection, Stephen thought it had been the case much earlier, since, quite apart from his delicacy at that period, Jack hated showing away. Now, in the warm night, there was no one to be comforted, kept in countenance, no one who could scorn him for virtuosity, and he could let himself go entirely. And as the grave and subtle music wound on and on, Stephen once more contemplated on the apparent contradiction between the big, cheerful, florid sea officer whom most people liked on sight, but who would never have been described as subtle or capable of subtlety by any one of them, except perhaps his surviving opponents in battle, and the intricate, reflective music he was now creating. So utterly unlike his limited vocabulary in words, at times verging upon the inarticulate. "My hands have now regained the moderate ability they possessed before I was captured," observed Maturin. "But his have gone on to a point I never thought he could reach. His hands and his mind. I am amazed. In his own way he is the secret man of the world. But I wish his music were happier." In the early morning light, however, he was playing Jack Aubrey, and as they walked over the dew towards his observatory, he said,
"If I had not officially appointed Adams my secretary, I should ask him to stay here and help Sophie with her papers. The Woolcombe estate is nothing much, poor spewy land most of it, but it is amazingly troublesome with some uncommon wicked tenants, poachers to a man, and she tries to look after it all herself, to say nothing of this place, and the infernal income tax, the poor rate, the tithes. What is that bird?"
"It is a shrike, a great grey shrike. Some say warriangle."
"Yes, Cousin Edward's keeper calls them that. He showed me a nest when I was a boy. But speaking of tithes, we have a new parson, Mr. Hinksey. Do you remember him?"
"I do not, unless he was the gentleman I met once or twice in my booksellers, and who was good enough to carry some naval essays down to Sophie."
"He was the man that made addresses to her when we were taking poor Mr. Stanhope to the East Indies, to Kampong. Mrs. Williams thought the world of him. Such a gentlemanlike parson, with a good living and 500 or even 600 a year of his own. He was something at Oxford, a wrangler, perhaps. Do they have wranglers at Oxford, Stephen?"
"I rather believe it is the other place. At Oxford, I think they only have fornicatories, but I may well be mistaken."
"Well, it was something creditable, in any event. And she declares the reason he has never married is that Sophie broke his heart running off to marry me. But now here he is, installed in our rectory, these 18 months at least. Ain't it amazing?"
"I have rarely been more astonished."
"I was perfectly prepared to hate him, of course, but he is such an open, friendly, agreeable fellow, a very fair horseman, and an uncommon good bat, that I could not succeed. A big, well-built man, 6 foot odd, and he used to box at college. He has a broken nose."
"That is a recommendation, sure."
"Well, it does mean he cannot decently prate away in the evangelical line, like some parson and some of our blue light officers with their pious tracts. And he has come over from time to time when Sophie's mamma, or Sophie herself, were quite at a loss with their sums, which I take very civil. But, Lord, how I wander. I was talking about Adams. Now, as you know very well, there is a world of difference between a flag officer's secretary and a captain's clerk, and having appointed him, I cannot in decency ask him to stay ashore and help Sophie. But I shall certainly desire him to look about among his friends in Plymouth and Gosport. Here we are. Stephen, mind the ditch. Tread in the middle of the plank. I brought you this roundabout way to show you a creeper I'm trying to persuade to turn the pollard into a bower, but it seems to have been swallowed by the nettles. Now let me go in first and refocus. There is a prodigious difference between a morning and an evening speculum, of course, and then you shall see all the squadron there is to be seen. Some of the brigs and a schooner or two are only to join us off Lisbon. You will not see them in their full detail, with the light coming from the east, but I hope you will get at least some notion."
No man would ordinarily have associated Jack Aubrey with the idea of fuss, yet this was a special case. He had made the telescope, grinding 7 mirrors before achieving the present masterpiece. He had invented the improved mounting as well as the singularly exact finder, and in this single instance he did fuss, trying to make it perform miracles, urging the sun to shed a diffused and even illumination, uttering otiose explanations.
Stephen disregarded his friend's anxious prattle, most of it deeply technical, dealing with diffraction, aberration, and virtual images, and gazed upon the successive remote and silent visions as they appeared in the eyepiece. First, the splendid Bellona, in profile. Some of her people were still washing the forecastle and all that was to be seen of the upper deck, while the afterguard and waisters flogged the poop and quarterdeck dry.
74 guns, of course, said Jack. A broadside weight of metal of 926 pounds. 28 36-pounders on the gun deck, 28 18-pounders on the upper deck, 2 long 12s as chasers, and 6 short with 10 32-pound carronades and 4 little ones for the poop.
That makes 78 guns.
For shame, Stephen. Surely you must recall that we only make a notional reckoning for the carronades when we count them in at all.
I beg pardon.
She's a Chatham ship. 1,615 tons, gun deck 168 foot, beam 46 foot 9, and she has a depth of 19 foot 9 in the hold, which I call really comfortable. With 6 months' stores, she draws 22 foot 9 abaft, less of whore, of course.
When was she built?
In 1760, said Jack in a somewhat unwilling, defensive voice. But you would not call her an old ship. The Victory was laid down a year before, and she is pretty spry, I believe. She answered tolerably well at Trafalgar, they say. Besides, the Bellona was doubled and braced in the year 5, and she is, if anything, better than new. Far better, with everything well shaken into position.
I beg pardon.
She was always an uncommonly weatherly ship. I remember her well in the West Indies when I was a boy. Rolls easy, makes 9 and even 10 knots close-hauled on a brisk-to-gallant breeze, steers away, wears quick, lies too perfectly well under main course and mizzen staysail, fore-reaching prodigiously all the while. Amazing great wash.
I rejoice to hear it. Pray state the number of her crew.
The establishment is 590. I should think we are within a score or two of it, and I have great hopes of a draft from the Nore on Monday. But that is Tom's concern, you know. I only have to worry with the paperwork. The Admiralty, the Navy Board, the Port Admiral, and the other captains belonging to the squadron. Now let me show you our other line of battleship.
A little wheel turned. Masts, yards, loose sails, rigging, and stretches of pale gleaming water shot sideways through Stephen's field of vision. A sudden trembling halt, and there, as sharp, firm, and distinct as Jack or any other telescope maker could have wished, swam another two-decker. Not sideways this time, but seen from 4 points on her starboard bow, a three-quarter view that showed her exactly squared yards to great advantage. Her sides were painted black, and her gun ports a fine, clear blue, while above them ran a line of the same colour, a combination that gave Stephen's heart a strange wrench, it being so much favoured by Diana.
"That is stately, the 64," said Jack. "She was inflicted upon us when they took the Terrible away, as shabby a piece of favouritism and jobbery as the service has ever known."
"Her captain is clearly a man of taste, however," said Stephen.
"Well, I'm no judge of taste. I'm not a dilettante, but if the Nelson checker was good enough for the great man himself, it is good enough for me."
Jack paused.
"And I tell you what, Stephen, I do not like saying anything behind anyone's back, but you are a medico, and that makes it different. You will understand. As you know, I hate the way sodomites are hanged or flogged round the fleet, and I like Duff, but you must not do it with a young foremast jacks, or discipline goes by the board. Duff is a pretty good seaman, and he does his best, but the Stately had taken all night to tow to her berth. And in any case, there really is an old ship for you. She may not have been launched until 82, but she was on the Brest blockade for years and years, which wore her out before her time, those frightful southwesters lasting for weeks on end with tremendous seas, and she has neither been doubled nor braced. She is now about as seaworthy as the Ark after Noah left her high and dry on the top of Ararat. Perhaps the slowest of her miserable class, sagging to leeward so as to make even a Midland ploughboy stare. Yet, since we have to live with her, I will tell you she gauges 1,370 tons, 159 foot 6 inches on the gun deck, with a beam of 44 foot 4. She carries 26 24-pounders, 26 18-pounders, 6 9-pounders, and 16 mixed carronades, a broadside of only 792 pounds, against the Terrible's 1,000-odd. And if she can manage to fire 2 in 5 minutes, it is looked upon as a wonder. Let us look at something more cheerful.
Again the rushing blur.
"Oh!" cried Jack in a much happier voice. "I had not expected her so soon. You recognise her, of course?"
Stephen made no reply.
"The Nimble cutter, in which that good young fellow Michael Fitton brought us home from the Groyne. but I must not linger on her. Now, here, look, is our prime jewel, Pyramus, a really modern 36-gun, 18-pounder frigate, 920 tons, 141-foot on the gun deck, 38-foot-5 beam, broadside weight of metal, 467 pounds, crew of 259 in capital order, long together, thoroughly used to their captain, that fine, taut, spirited fellow, Frank Holden, and to their officers, some of whom have sailed with us.
He gazed at the ship with great approval, and then moved on.
"This is Aurora, our second frigate," he said. "Another antique, I am afraid. She was laid down in 1771, and she only carries 24 9-pounders, as they did in those days. But I have an affection for her because of the surprise. Not that she is anything like so fast, or weatherly, or comfortable. 596 tons, 120-foot-6 on the gun deck, and she probably has 150 of her 196 complement by now. Francis Howard has her, the Grecian. But you know him perfectly well. We met off Lesbos. Now, beyond her, towards St. Helens, lie the Camille, 20, just a rated ship, Orestes, a brig-rigged sloop, and some other craft. I will tell you about them as we ride down, and indeed show you when we are there. But for now I should think you've had enough."
"Not at all," said Stephen, rising from his intolerably cramped position. "It is a far more imposing command than I had imagined, and far more glorious."
"It is, ain't it?" said Jack, guiding him out of the observatory. "Even without the terrible, and in spite of our old crocks, it is a very fine squadron. I'm as proud as Pontius Pilate. But, you know, it is a shocking responsibility. In Mauritius I had the Admiral behind me, even though he was rather far behind. Here I shall be entirely alone."
Sophie met them on their way up to the house. She was in strikingly good looks, but at the same time her expression was uneasy. She called out one of the reasons for this while they were still at some distance. Mama and Mrs. Morris had gone back to Bath, taking Briggs with them. She had let them have the coach, but Bentley would bring it back as soon as the horses were rested. This was a far more decided action than Stephen had ever known her take, yet she did not seem to think it of much consequence. It was not the disposal of a coach and a pair of horses that was disturbing her mind, still less the absence of her mother.
"Oh!" cried Jack, with no more than a nod at the news. "Oh, the smell of bacon and coffee, and even," opening the door, "of toasted soft tack. There is no finer beginning to a day. And kippered herrings, too!"
They sat down, just the three of them, in the breakfast parlour, the pleasantest room in the house, and part of the original Ashgrove cottage, as it was before Jack Aubrey, during those spates of gold that sometimes reached the more fortunate commanders in that prize-taking war, had thrown out wings, stable blocks, the double coach-house, bow windows here and there, the corner balcony, and a row of cottages for old shipmates. Just the three of them, for although the children were much loved and cherished, they ate with Miss O'Hara, sitting quite straight, never touching the backs of their chairs, and speaking only when they were spoken to. The fine, plump kippers were soon dispatched. The first coffee pot had been emptied, and Jack was silently engaged with his eggs and bacon, listening with half an ear to Stephen's minute and circumstantial account of the Madras fashion of making kedgeree, when Killick made his courtly appearance, jerked his chin in the direction of the Commodore, and said,
"Which the Port Admiral's flag lieutenant is come, and begs the favour. I told awkward Davis to take his horse to the stable and put him in the Velvet Saloon."
Velvet had strong connotations of wealth, and for Killick so had the word saloon, and since the front morning room contained one velvet-covered chair and a few cushions, nothing could induce him to call it anything else. Only commissioned officers were ushered in.
"Oh," said Jack, swallowing his coffee, "forgive me, my dear, I shall be back in a moment. It is the weekly return for sure."
But minutes went by, and the toast grew cold. Clearly something more complex than weekly returns was in question. Sophie felt the second coffee pot for warmth, nodded, and poured Stephen yet another cup.
"How pleasant to see you sitting there again," she said. "I have hardly had you to myself for 5 minutes, even after all this dreadfully long absence, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles. Nor Jack, either. Always messages from the Admiral, or people coming to ask for appointments, or to have their boy taken aboard one of the ships. And then, although he is so delighted with this splendid command, it must lead to a flag, Stephen, must it not? He is sadly worried, too, above all with this perpetual chopping and changing. There are worries about Parliament as well, and the Woolcombe estate. Oh, Stephen, we were so much happier when we were poor.
now there is so much to do and so much to worry about, and the loathsome bank that will not answer letters, that there is no time even to talk as we used. Only next Thursday there is a dinner for all the captains, although it is our anniversary, and someone is sure to get drunk. Tell me, how do you find him after all these weeks?"
"More worn than I could wish," said Stephen, looking at her.
"Yes," said Sophie, and she paused before going on. "And there is something on his mind. He is not the same. It is not only the ships and all the business. Besides, the invaluable Mr. Adams takes a great deal of that off his hands. No, there is a sort of reserve. It is not that he is in the least unkind, but you might almost say a coldness. No, that would be an absurd exaggeration. But he often sleeps in his study because of the paperwork or because he is out late. And even when he does not, he gets up at night and walks about until the morning."
In this most unpromising conversation, Stephen could find nothing better to say than, "Perhaps he will be happier once he gets to sea," which earned him a reproachful look. Both were poised to say something almost certainly unfortunate when Jack came in from seeing the flag lieutenant off, the remains of a farewell smile still on his face. It died entirely as he said,
"I am afraid I was right about Pyramus. She is to be taken away from the squadron, and we are to have the Thames instead. The Thames, a 32-gun, 12-pounder ship."
"Only 4 guns less than Pyramus," observed Sophie, in one of those ill-fated attempts at comfort.
"Certainly, but her 32 guns are only 12-pounders, as against Pyramus's 18s, and her broadside weight of metal is a mere 300 pounds, as against 467. But whining will do no good. Come, Stephen, we must be away. Is there another cup of coffee?"
"Oh, dear," cried Sophie, "I am afraid there is not. But it will not take 5 minutes to make another pot."
She rang the bell, but she rang in vain. Jack was already on the wing, urging Stephen through the door before him.
"You will not forget that the Fanshawes and Miss Lisa and Mr. Hinksey are coming to dinner?" she called.
"I shall try to be back in time," replied Jack. "But if the Admiral keeps me, you will make my excuses, if you please. Fanshawe will certainly understand."
They rode down through what was now quite a respectable wood, Stephen on his neat little mare, Jack on a new and powerful bay gelding. He broke a longish silence to say,
"I was telling you about that parson, Hinksey, yesterday."
"You said you could not hate him, as I recall."
"Just so. But although I could not manage a full-blown hatred, now that I'm so goddamned vexed at losing Pyramus, I will tell you that I cannot like him neither. He comes far too often for my taste, and he walks about the house as though... Once I found him sitting in my own particular chair, and although he jumped up directly with a very proper excuse, it put me out amazingly. And he and Sophie talk about things that happened when I was at sea. There is your worryangle again, carrying a mouse, upon my word."
Stephen spoke of shrikes he had known, particularly the woodchat shrike of his boyhood, at some length, and he offered to show Jack the difference between the chiff-chaff and the willow wren, several of which were flitting about in the leaves just overhead. But finding that the Commodore was sunk in a grim reverie, perhaps on the subject of frigates, inferior ships of the line, and the criminal levity of those who sent some thousands of men to sea with no consistent plan, no intelligent preparation, no adequate forewarning, he refrained. They rowed in silence as far as the bridge to Portsea Island, where Jack cried,
"Good Lord, we're at the bridge already. Stephen, you've lost your tongue, I find. You have been in a deep study. We are already at the bridge."
The discovery pleased him disproportionately. So did the proof of the gelding's remarkably easy pace. He had digested his ill humour, and they rode through the familiar, squalid outskirts of the town, through the still more squalid streets, quite cheerfully, and so to the Keppel's Head, the favourite inn of Jack's days as a midshipman. Here they put up their horses and walked on to the hard as the clocks were striking 10. Bondon was waiting for them with many a well-known smiling face among Jack's bargemen, and they pulled with the exactly dipped oars and the stately pace of a flag officer's boat, scorning the small craft that threaded the great harbour in all directions. A long pull, since the Bologna was lying right over by Haslar, and Stephen's mind, lulled by the steady rhythm, swam far, far back to woodchat shrikes again, to the sun-baked Catalan side of his childhood, and he was thinking in the language when Jack, to his coxswain's disappointment, said,
"Larboard."
This was no time to be worrying a busy ship, still taking in stores, still somewhat short-handed, with a ceremonial arrival on the starboard side. But it grieved Bonden, who, like Killick, dearly loved pomp and ceremony where his officer was concerned, dearly relished the stamp and clash of the Marines presenting arms when Jack was piped aboard to a quarterdeck full of attentive officers and midshipmen, and who had hoped that Stephen might be shown the Commodore's present glory. Yet since he had no choice, he brought the barge round in order that Jack might join his ship discreetly. Discreetly, but not unnoticed. Of course the boat had been seen putting off, and of course Captain Pullings was there to receive him, and of course there were side boys scrubbed pink, offering man ropes as he came nimbly up, which was just as well, since he was immediately followed by Dr. Maturin, as impervious to sea lore as Mr. Aubrey was to elegant literature. More so, indeed, since Jack had read Macbeth aloud, enchanting his daughters, not long since, while Stephen had not thought of ships or the sea since he set foot on shore, and had contrived to forget almost all of what little he had ever acquired. Furthermore, he had only been aroused from his dreamlike state a moment before, when the barge came alongside and the even motion stopped. Bonden and most of the bargemen were well acquainted with his occasional absences, and perfectly aware of the weakness of his nautical acquirements. And although the sea was duck pond calm, they anxiously propped him from behind, adjuring him to clap on to them man ropes, sir, them padded things, and placing his feet successively on the steps. And they got him aboard, dryfoot. Something of a triumph. Yet once there, he stared about in a very simple, moonstruck fashion. For a great while now, in the whole breadth of the world, his ship had been a small frigate. And although, years before, he had been in a ship of the line for a short while, the recollection had entirely faded. His scale was that of the surprise, and the hugeness of the Bellona, the presence of a poop, and of all these people quite bewildered him. He was at a disadvantage, and his face took on a cold, withdrawn expression. But his old friend Tom Pullings, now advancing to shake his hand and welcome him aboard, was even better acquainted with the doctor's vagaries than the bargemen, and speaking very loud and clear, told him that two of his assistant surgeons had reported aboard last night, and were now waiting for him in the sick berth. Perhaps he would like to see them before Tom named the officers to him. "Mr. Weatherby," he said to a fresh-faced youngster in brand-new uniform, "pray show the doctor to the sick berth." Down to the upper deck, with its long ranges of 18-pounders on either side. Down again by the after ladderway to the gun deck, dim at present, with the gun ports closed for painting.
"That is where I live, sir," said the youngster, pointing to the gunroom.
Stephen was in civilian clothes. He presented no marks whatsoever of following the sea in any capacity, and the child explained things to him.
"I'm not yet rated midshipman, you know, sir, so I mess with the gunner with half a dozen other coves, and the gunner's wife is very good to us. She shows us how to mend our clothes. Now, sir," guiding Stephen forward, "here, pray mind your step. Beyond that piece of screen is where the people sleep, all of them, jam-packed, chock-a-block, when hammocks are piped down, and the screened bit is what we call the sick berth."
In the darkness stood two figures, dim themselves, but clearly nervous.
"Good morning, gentlemen," said Stephen. "I am the ship's surgeon, Maturin."
"Good morning, sir," they replied, and the first assistant said, "My name is Smith, sir, William Smith, formerly of the Serapis and of the hospital at Bridgetown."
The second, blushing, said that he was Alexander Macaulay, that after his apprenticeship he had studied at Guy's, where he was dresser to Mr. Findlay for nearly 5 months. This was his first appointment.
"Are we indeed in the Bellona's sick berth?" asked Stephen, shocked. "Mr. Weatherby, be so good as to jump up to the quarterdeck and ask the officer of the watch if I may have a gun port open."
He had barely spoken before there was a creak, a heave, and the nearest port rose up, letting in a square flood of light and showing two beaming faces, Joe Place and Michael Kelly, both Jack Aubrey's followers since the time of his first command, the brig Sophie, and both very old friends of Stephen's.
"Joe Place and Michael Kelly," said Stephen, shaking their hands through the gun port. "I rejoice to see you. Joe, how is the headpiece?"
The seamen looked sharply up at some order from on high.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
they cried to the distant officer, winked privately at Stephen, and vanished. Stephen returned to the immediate abomination.
"Can such things be?" he cried.
looking at the partially folded canvas screen, the few bare cots, a little more hanging sailcloth ragged at the bottom, and then the vast cavern of the lower deck, empty now but for the rows of 32-pounders and the mess tables hanging between them, but crammed at night with all the hundreds of seamen and marines, apart from the watch on deck, snoring and breathing. Above all, breathing the very small quantities of air, and exhaling it in a vitiated condition, pernicious to themselves and even more so to invalids.
Can such things be? It is archaic. It belongs to the Dark Ages. This is the unhealthiest part of the ship. Unbreathable air. Impossible for a sick man to go to the head, hands trampling to and fro, shouting and bawling at every meal, every change of the watch, and the present stench, although the deck has been cleaned, for it is still wet. Another evil point.
He sniffed. Sniffed again, and recognized both the scent and the distant hurdles, the ship's pigs right forward in their sty. He had heard of it in ships of the past, and he had seen it once at the very beginning of his career.
This cannot be. Where are the men in the sick list?
I believe they were all removed to Haslar, sir, when the late surgeon died. An alcoholic coma, I am told.
Infamous,
said Stephen, not so much at the alcoholic coma as at the monstrous surroundings.
Let us look at the dispensary, and then I can make my report. Mr. Weatherby, pray show the way.
The child led them forward to a ladderway from which the sty was even clearer, the smell much stronger. The pigs looked up at them, their little intelligent eyes full of curiosity. Down into the darkness of the orlop, beneath the waterline, where by the faint gleam of reflected light that filtered down through grating after grating, and by an occasional lantern, they groped aft to the cockpit, the midshipman's berth, a noisy, noisome place. There were only four young gentlemen, one ape, and a bulldog in it at present, but they could be heard a great way off, and the youngster said,
"I should not dare go in, sir, if you was not with me. Mind your step, I beg."
"What would happen were you to go in?" asked Stephen.
"The oldsters and the master's mates would scrag me, sir, and feed me to the bulldog."
He opened the door and stood aside.
"Gentlemen, good day," said Stephen into the abrupt silence.
They were disparate creatures, one a dark, fierce-looking man sitting on the deck trying to read by a purser's dip, two gangling youths with their wrists and ankles starting from their clothes, and a devilish little 14-year-old trying to show the ape how to stand on its head. But they instantly saw that it would not do to play off their humours on this visitor, and they returned his greetings, standing up with what grace they could summon, while the devilish boy quite unnecessarily strangled the bulldog, advancing to pay its respects. Stephen looked round the cockpit, which was his action station, and which would be his operating theatre in the event of a battle. A fine, spacious theatre, since it ordinarily housed a score of young men, and walked on aft.
"Oh, sir," cried Mr. Weatherby again, "pray mind your step."
And well might he cry. The hatch to the after powder room was open, and the gunner's face framed in it a foot above the deck. The face, ordinarily grave, spread in a smile, and his right hand reached up.
"Why, doctor," he cried, "we heard you was coming, and right glad we were. Rowley, gunner's mate in the old Worcester."
"Of course," said Stephen, shaking his hand. "A nasty splinter wound in the gluteus maximus. How did it come along?"
"You would never know it, sir. I showed it to my old woman when I came home. I showed her the scar, what there was of it, and I said, 'Kate, if you could sew as good as the doctor, I should put you out to work and live at my ease.'"
With this he vanished like an inverted jack-in-a-box, and the hatch clapped down over him. Smith opened the dispensary door, and a strong light came out, coming from the operating lantern that hung within.
"I hope you will not think me over busy, sir," said he, "but last night the purser told me that some stores had come down from the sick and hurt board, and rather than leave them lying in the steward's care, I have been putting them in the medicine chest. I was still at it when your boat came alongside, so I left things as they were. I'm afraid they will not all go in."
The hatch opened abruptly. The gunner's beaming face reappeared.
"I said, 'Kate, if you could sew as well as the doctor, I should put you out to work and live at my ease,'"
and clapped to again over his laughter.
"You did perfectly well, Mr. Smith," said Stephen,
looking into the miniature apothecary's shop with its drawers, bottle racks, and recesses.
"But I'm afraid you are in the right of it. These," nodding at the powders, dried roots, drugs, ointments, bandages, dressings, tourniquets, and the like that covered the floor, "will never go in. We shall be obliged to stow them in the starboard dispensary."
"'By your leave, sir,' said Smith after a hesitation. "'There is no starboard dispensary.'
"'Jesus, Mary and Joseph!' cried Stephen. 590 souls to be dosed out of one miserable cupboard, 4 foot by 3 at the most. All of a piece throughout. Very well, gentlemen. Be so good as to put them into my cabin here,' opening the door of a room measuring 6 foot by 4, "'while I go and make my report to the captain. Oh, such a report, my God!'
"'Why, Doctor, what's amiss?' cried Tom Puddings as he burst in upon them.
"'Stephen, have you had a fall?'
asked Jack, starting up and taking him by the arm, for he was unnaturally pale, and his eyes glared extremely. He looked coldly at each in turn, and then, in a carefully controlled voice, he said,
"'I have just discovered that this vessel, for I will not call it a vile hulk, has a sick berth that would disgrace a Turk, a sick berth that a parcel of Hottentots would blush for, so they would. It is a sick berth so horrible that I cannot consent to be associated with it, and—' his voice now rising with passion, "'if it cannot be converted into something less like Golgotha, more designed to kill rather than to save, I wash my hands of it entirely.'
He washed his hands, glaring at their shocked faces.
"'I wash my hands, I say, the shame of the world!'
"'Pray, Stephen, sit down,' said Jack gently, leading him to a chair. "'Pray sit down and drink a glass of wine. Do not be cross with us, I beg.'
Pullings was too upset to say anything, but he poured the Madeira, and they both looked at Stephen with infinite concern. He was still pale, still furious.
"'Have either of you ever been in this odious travesty of a sick berth?'
he asked, his glare piercing first the one and then the other. Oh, the moral force of that wholly unfeigned, wholly disinterested and righteous anger! Jack slowly shook his head, his conscience cleared on at least that point. Tom Pullings said, "'I suppose I must have walked through on my way to see the pigsties. But since all the invalids were discharged to the hospital before ever I came aboard, there was nobody there, so I did not notice it was so very wrong.' Stephen told them that a sick berth with no peace, no light, no air could not possibly be right in any particular whatsoever. He told them in vehement detail, and his energy subsided a little. He told them that the only ship of the line sick berth he would consent to be associated with must of necessity banish the swine in favour of the Christian sick, must lie right forward under the forecastle, and must have light, air, and access to the head according to the plan of the eminently ingenious and truly benevolent Admiral Markham.
"'Doctor,' cried Tom, "'say but the word and I shall send for Chips and all his crew this moment. If you will direct them, you shall have your Markham sick berth before the evening gun.'
The tension fell. Stephen took a little wine. His colour, though still disagreeably sallow, returned to a natural pallor, rather than one blanched by fury. He smiled at them, and Captain Pullings sent for the carpenter.
"'Stephen,' said Jack diffidently, "'I had thought of carrying you round the other ships, so that you might meet their captains and officers. But I dare say making a proper sick berth would take up most of your time.'
"'So it would, too,' said Stephen, "'and all my energy.' "'Tom, you have the joiners of your own, have you not? "'I could wish to install a full dispensary there, "'where the swine gambled and wantoned at their ease, "'rather than send down to the after cockpit "'every time I need a black draught. "'Jack, I beg you will excuse me "'if I put off the meeting until your dinner "'for all these gentlemen.'